With a 50% obesity rate in the U.S. and more unhealthy people than ever before, it is time to make America healthy. Welcome to Make America Healthy with Beth Shaw. If you're feeling tired, toxic, heavy, slow, or stressed, then keep listening. Beth and her expert guests are here to offer practical advice and share the tools you need to reclaim your physical, mental, and emotional health. Now, here is your host, Beth Shaw.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to Make America Healthy. I hope that everyone is having a very healthy day. I've been on the road lately, traveling around to different conferences and events, and I'm seeing a lot of unhealthy people out there in the world. But I'm also seeing a lot of very happy, positive people and people who connect energetically. I've been meeting a lot of people at conferences and just kind of interacting with people just based on their energy and whether or not I feel like I'm going to feel some type of connection to them, which is a great lead in for our guest today, who I'm super excited to have. We're going to be talking about yoga, superpowers, telepathy, remote viewing, the conscious universe, and so much more. Our guest today is Dr. Dean Radin. He's the chief scientist at the Institute of Noetic Sciences. That's noetic.org. And he is also the author of numerous books, including The Conscious Universe, Entangled Minds, and my favorite book, Supernormal, which was all about telepathy, levitating. I still haven't mastered that one yet, despite the fact that I've been practicing yoga since I'm a child, remote viewing, and all things related to ESP and just being open in our third eye, which is increasingly hard to do in today's world, using our intuition, our insight to lead us and guide us, to connect us to the universal consciousness, to connect us with others and all of humanity. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Dean Radin. Dean, thank you so much and welcome to Make America Healthy.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Thanks. So Dean and I met actually in 2012 at a conference put on in Palm Desert by Noetic Sciences. And I have to say, I don't, you know, crush over celebrities. They don't really impress me, but I love scientists, which is why we have so many of them on this show. And I have all the admiration in the world for anyone who is doing that type of research in any field. And so Dean and I sat next to each other at the lunch and he was so gracious. He gave me his tomatoes. I still remember that. And I was a true super fan sitting next to him and just loved your book, Supernormal. So give our listeners just a little background on you, how you got started in this field, which some people might say is kind of out there. I like to think it's inside, in here, and also out there. So just give us a little bit of a background and how you got your start and what has propelled you into this line of work.
Well, so I'm now 70, and I've been doing this kind of research for about the last 40 years. When I was in college and then for my master's degree and graduate school, at that time, I thought I would probably end up being a concert violinist. That was the track that I was on. And somewhere in around the beginning of graduate school, I realized that it was possible to make a living doing something other than playing music. Especially in the violin, no one ever told me, in retrospect, it was obvious, but no one told me up to that point that being a professional musician means that you're an athlete because you're making your living with your body.
Yeah. Well, I can relate.
It's true, right? So I was never been particularly strong or had very high stamina. And I realized that although I could play technically very well, I didn't have the stamina to be able to play 4 hours to 6 hours every single day. Now, I had been practicing about an hour a day for many, many years, 20 years. And I always found it kind of exhausting. So I figured, well, this is not a good profession for me. Unfortunately, I was also always good in mathematics and science. And so instead of becoming a concert violinist, initially I got 2 degrees in electrical engineering and then went on to get a doctorate in psychology. The underlying theme in all of that is that I wasn't particularly interested in engineering, and nor was I particularly interested in psychology. I was really interested in what are the potentials of the mind. But there was no curriculum for that. So I went and got traditional degrees because that's all that was available. But all during that time, I was curious about the experiences that people report throughout history up to the present day that suggests that the mind and the brain are not the same thing. And it was part of looking at the literature in this domain, which today we'd think of as esoteric literature, which in the Eastern world is primarily yoga, and in the Western world is primarily magic, essentially. Things like Neoplatonism and Hermeticism. And so what's interesting is that all of those esoteric traditions provide a worldview that is very different than the scientific worldview. The scientific worldview is based on materialism, where everything is made out of matter and energy and full stop. And from that perspective, you are your brain. And you see many books with that title, you are your brain. Change your brain, you're changed. And so it's undeniable that there are aspects of brain activity which are associated with the way that you experience the world, but that doesn't tell us actually anything about what it is like from the inside. So the subjective sense, your experiential sense, the feeling of what it's like to eat a lemon, for example, you can't tell that by looking at it from the outside. You can only get that from the inside. So kind of being interested in that domain, I was interested in meditation and yoga and all of these, what we might no longer think of as esoteric, but at one time they were definitely esoteric practices. I was doing that back when I was in my early 20s. So that's already 50 years ago.
And were you actually practicing at that time? Were you practicing some of the things you talk about in Supernormal?
Oh, yeah. So I started learning meditation when I was 20 in college. And this was at a time when transcendental meditation was infiltrating colleges, and I was attracted to it immediately. And so I started meditating then. And so off and on, from then till now, many different techniques. TM was one, but I've sort of gravitated towards Vipassana as something that I can do and enjoy and will sustain over long periods of time. And the same goes for yoga. So once you begin to look at the classical yoga, and this was the origins of the book that I called Supernormal, it's very clear that the yoga of today is kind of like a spiritualized form of calisthenics, but that's not how it was, that's not its origins. So I began to look into the origins, and of course you immediately end up with the Yoga Sutras. And the thing about the Yoga Sutras is that it was the first written form of an oral tradition, which goes back thousands of years. We don't even know how far back it went. So what's curious about it is made out of 3 little books written by an Indian sage called Patanjali. And 3 of the books are about the techniques of yoga, but one of those books is about what happens as a result of doing disciplined meditation. And it's all about psychic phenomena, some of which we can and have tested in the laboratory, and we know that it's real. And some of which we would like to test in the laboratory, but we can't find anybody who can actually do these things.
Well, yeah, I was going to say sign me up, but there's a lot that I still can't do.
Yeah. So the things.
And I've been practicing yoga for a long time.
Well, you shouldn't feel too bad, because when you look at people who've been meditating for 40 to 50 years, 10, 12 hours a day, like monks, they know very well that some people will develop certain kinds of mental powers, but many will not. And so some of this is due to the practice. Some of it is due to natural talent. And so then if you don't have the natural talent, you can get to a certain plateau, but it's very difficult to get beyond that plateau.
Well, that makes perfect sense. And later in the show, we're going to just give our listeners some key points and how they can improve their telepathy and ESP and all of that. I find that the more tuned in I am to those superpowers, the more effortlessly they just happen. I just got back from a conference for small businesses in Washington, D.C. And, you know, there were over 2,500 people there, business owners from all over the country. And of course, you know, I want to meet so many business owners and learn about their businesses, but I just kind of just set the intention to the universe that I was going to connect energetically with the people that I was supposed to. And my like prayer, if you will, was, you know, let the universe lead and guide me to the right people. And without trying, without having intention, like I have to meet this person or that person, it naturally unfolded so beautifully for me. And the people that I needed to run into, I kept running into again and again. So, you know, one of my focuses is to develop more of these powers within myself, because my thought is, and Dean, maybe you can lend more science to what I'm about to say, but if we can send a text message to someone and, you know, type into our phone and the what waves or, you know, the network that carries it, someone's going to get that message from me within 2 minutes. You know, isn't there a part of our brain and consciousness that can send those messages without the phone?
Yeah, probably has very little to do with the brain. It has more to do with the mind.
Okay.
And or consciousness. The brain is inside your head, 3 pounds of tissue. That is probably responsible for what we can think of as information processing. It's the thing that takes information in through your senses and creates the picture of the world as we experience it. It probably does not, or at least is not completely responsible for our internal experience, our sense of awareness, for example. So you can devise a computer which will simulate, as AI is doing today, a lot of the cognitive and perceptual processes that are involved in our experience, but those computers probably don't have an internal sense of it. So that when I say consciousness, I'm talking about this internal subjective sense of awareness. All of our studies, all of the esoteric traditions suggest that that is not in your head. Feels like it's in your head, but it isn't.
So would you say that that is the consciousness that we possess, we all possess within us, that just might be more fine-tuned in some than others?
Yes. Anybody who has a sense of sentience, especially like self-awareness, that's what consciousness is. Self-awareness, the thing that you call me. The processing that's going on of the information that your senses are pulling in, including information coming from somewhere else, both in space and time, that is a combination of brain processing plus awareness, plus consciousness itself. So I'm making this distinction because the various superpowers that the yogis talk about, it's probably not based in physicality in the way that science currently understands. And so that distinction is important because if you ask a conservative scientist about ESP, they'll either dismiss it offhand as impossible, or they'll say, well, how can that possibly work? Because the only kind of signals that we know that could possibly carry these things are like electromagnetism, stuff like that. And how could it work?
And mirror neurons are not going to work when someone's, you know, in another country and you're here in the US.
Probably not.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, maybe they will be stimulated in some way, but the information is not coming like the signal that goes to your cell phone. It's not an electromagnetic basis, it's something else.
So in your book, Supernormal, you talk a lot about extrasensory perception, which is extra. You also speak a lot about remote viewing. And after reading your book, I got really curious about remote viewing. I had done a plant medicine ceremony with some people that were actually trained in remote viewing. It was a couple they had met at this remote viewing workshop somewhere in Texas. And I was like, I'm going to go and take that course. I never got around to it. So can you just talk about like remote viewing versus ESP versus telepathy just so we all have an understanding?
They're all very much the same thing.
Okay.
We give different labels to the way that the experience manifests. So we will call something telepathy if it appears as though you have similar thoughts or feelings about a distant person, but that's just a label.
Okay.
We call it remote viewing, otherwise known as clairvoyance. If you're getting sensory kind of information or impressions from a distance, either in space or time. So it could be the thoughts or feelings of another person. That's why you can immediately see an overlap between telepathy and clairvoyance and or remote viewing. They're all part of the same thing. And likewise, if you have a sense that your intentions manifest in a way that you want, as you were saying, that you went to a conference and you wanted to meet certain people, well, that sets an intention. If the intention is very clear and you focus on it, it tends to unfold. Well, that is probably related to these kinds of phenomena as well. So we use a general term psi, which is PSI. It's the first letter of the Greek. It's the letter of the Greek alphabet. It is the for the word psyche, which is the Greek word meaning mind or soul. So it's just a catch-all term for all of these phenomena, which are all related in some way. So there is no difference between ESP and remote viewing. There are different ways in which we describe the experience.
In your book, you talked a lot about, was it the FBI or the CIA used to do a lot of training people actually to do remote viewing. Give us a little history there, and how does this work?
There was a program, a classified program run by the government from 1972 to 1995, which was engaged in psychic espionage. And so they called it remote viewing as the technique, kind of as a euphemism, so they didn't have to say this is clairvoyance, because that's what it was. It was using people who are naturally talented, who were able to do remote viewing to get information about enemies, basically espionage.
And the accuracy in which some of these experiments were conducted blew my mind.
Some of the individual cases of about 500 operational missions, those are missions where some agency, one of many different agencies in the US government, they wanted to know something about something at a distance. And so there are roughly 500 such cases, and some of them were shockingly good. In general, they usually were not good enough to base an operation solely on psychic information. That would be very rare. In fact, it's even very rare today, even with spy satellites and other methods. When you're doing a mission, you take all of the information you can possibly get from every possible source. And so the ESP component became one possible source that an analyst would use in order to figure out what was going on somewhere else. So the somewhat different aspect of this was people were selected because they were open to the possibility of these kinds of phenomena. They were recruited for that. Plus, they also reported that they had these kinds of experiences spontaneously in their lives. So you already had people who are predisposed to having some ability, probably. And then Ingo Swann, an artist who was naturally psychic, created a training program. So today, if you take a course in remote viewing, you can trace the lineage of that all the way back to Ingo Swann. And there are many different techniques that are taught, but they're all basically the same. They're ways of giving you tips and tricks on how to gain impressions about something which doesn't happen to be close to you, but is distant in space or time.
Well, I'm so fascinated by this whole field, and I'm going to put on my list of things to do to definitely take a course. I've never seen ghosts. I'm going to say that, and I know that's something different, but I've been very intuitive throughout my life. I think teaching myself how to do meditation to cure my migraine headaches when I was six was a little bit of a, you know, spiritual intervention somewhere along the line, or whatever you want to call it. And, you know, I also believe that it's so important for us to keep our bodies in good shape, healthy, eat clean food, keep the fluoride out of our water so that our third eye doesn't shut down. I'm wondering where also these powers of telepathy, clairvoyance, and all of that, most people, either if they have them, they'll know about them, right? So the people who signed up to be part of this experiment that or this training that lasted a very long time through the government, they must have known they had some special powers, much like the, you know, you'll hear about the psychic that was hired to find the dead body somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Right. So while people were, they did go through some training, most of the people were using their natural ability, and all of them were part of the military. But there are two sides of that classified program. There was an operational side, which was in the Army, the U.S. Army, and there was a research side. So I was on the research side, and our mission was basically twofold. One was to figure out how do we select people who have these talents and how do we make them better? And the third aspect was threat assessment. So the government gets really interested in something that might be a threat
right.
to national security. And because we were doing this kind of program, we strongly suspected that at the time, the Soviet Union and maybe the Chinese and other countries were doing similar things. We had heard rumors of such effects. So we would get information about what the Soviets were doing.
And were they? I'm curious because, you know, I listen to all different types of things, and I have heard things about the training that you get in Russia, physical training as well as other trainings. Were China or the USSR, were they doing similar type experiments?
We know that the Russians were. They definitely had a program which was funded to a much greater extent than the one in the US and had many more people involved. We suspect about the Chinese even to the present day, but we don't know for sure. They're much more quiet about it. One of the reasons why we think the Chinese are involved in this is because it is not a cultural difficulty as it is in the U.S. So in the U.S., we're very materialistic. That's where science works. It's very difficult to understand how these phenomena can exist from a Western science perspective.
Because no one's going to fund the research, right?
Well, it was funded, but in a classified condition, right? So we were funded, but nobody knew it at the time.
And in order to write your book, did you have your non-disclosure? Did it expire? Like how did that work that you were able to talk about classified details after the fact?
Because in 1995, almost all of the what was called the Stargate program was declassified. That's why.
Okay.
And today, if somebody wanted to know all of the details, almost all, most of the details, there's a four-volume series called the Stargate Archives. Each book, it's like a big format book and big fat book, 700 or 800 pages per volume, which goes through all of the research and all of the background machinations that go on in the government in order to get these kinds of things going. So there's an enormous amount that is actually available now to learn about that whole program.
And I've heard in terms of UFOs and other type, I know there's a new term for them. All that information has also been declassified. We were at our Yoga Fit Mind Body Fitness Conference in Scottsdale last week, and a group of us were talking. Someone lived near that Area 51 and their uncle was a scientist there. And they said that, you know, you can pretty much go online now and view all of the documents about visitors from another planet. And then we started to talk about Skinwalker Ranch and all the paranormal activities that are happening there. And we decided we wanted to put a retreat together and go there and check it out. They're documenting all kinds of stuff from that location. Have you been following that at all?
Yeah, I know some of the people who have been investigating it, and I've read a few books and watched a TV show, that's about the extent of it. My sense of it is that I've done investigations of haunted castles in Europe and other places in the United States. Those I feel comfortable with. I'm not so comfortable, given what I've heard about the Skinwalker Ranch. Because, I mean, things happen there that are generally not that good for you.
So planning a retreat there probably wouldn't be the best idea.
Not if you want to feel comfortable, no.
Okay. I don't want to bring an entity back with me.
Yeah.
And does that happen, by the way? Do you believe that happens?
I actually have an experience of that. Maybe we'll save it until after the break.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's a good one to save to after the break. Right. So tell us a little bit about Noetic Sciences.
We started almost 50 years ago, 1973, by the Apollo 14 astronaut Edgar Mitchell, who was the sixth man to step on the moon. When Edgar was coming back to the Earth, his job was finished because he was the lunar module pilot. And so the way he describes it is that he's looking out of the window at the Earth. Only something like a dozen people have seen the Earth the size of a marble. And it sparked a mystical experience, a very classic experience of feeling of unity with the entire universe. And it was so shocking to him that when he came back to the Earth, he was determined to use the tools and techniques of science, because he had been trained in that, to find out what is that experience. He had read about it, but having had it firsthand, he realized that this is not just a story, but it is a palpable sense of feeling everything all together at once. And so it was shocking to him. So that started our institute to investigate mystical and psychic experiences using the tools of science. And that's what we've been doing for almost 50 years.
And you all have like a campus in Northern California, right?
Up until a short time ago, yes. For 20 years, we had a campus called Earthrise in Northern California, which was recently sold. So we're in the process of looking for a new place.
I always wanted to visit there also. I know you used to do workshops and retreats there. I'd love to come in residence when you get your new facility and just study for a while. Tell us about your new book, Real Magic.
That was published in 2018, and it is the Western esoteric tradition, kind of twin for supernormal, which is the Eastern esoteric traditions. So the reason why I wrote it is because I knew that what a yogi would call the siddhis, the special powers, have their match in the West. And in the West, they're called magic. But they're basically the same thing. The yogic siddhi and magic are the same.
Yeah, I never really related magic and yoga because, in my opinion, magicians pull things out of hats and make people disappear. And I don't know how much of any of that is actually real.
It is real. So to make the distinction between stage magic.
Okay,
which is illusions.
Yeah.
And the real thing, real magic. That's why I call the book Real Magic. It's all about, from a Western perspective, what the yogis would call siddhis.
Okay.
That's what it is.
So can you give us some examples of real magic?
Well, so real magic are practices that fall into three categories. One is called divination, which the yogis used as well, which is perceiving through space and time. The second category is called force of will, which we might call something like manifestation.
Okay.
And the third category is called theurgy, which is a Greek word that translates into working with spirits. So evoking spirits, doing things with spirits. So those are the three practices that are part of classical Western magic. And there is a parallel in the Eastern traditions as well.
So magic like the Wicca people would use and back in Massachusetts, they used that those witches use this is the type of magic you're referring to.
Well, in a very simple sense, yes. So when people in current covens or people called witches, they will do rituals, which you can trace back for a few thousand years into these traditions. I didn't focus that much on current magic or even on ancient magical traditions, but it, as I said, there's a very strong parallel, a complete parallel with what has been done in the East. So the culture will shape how the phenomena are portrayed and the practices, but the underlying essence of them are the same.
It's funny because I've always been so drawn to yoga and meditation and enhancing my consciousness and, you know, keeping my third eye open and all of that. I've never been really drawn to anything around magic or witchcraft, because for me, that conjures up a little bit of a darker connotation and seems a little bit scary. Yeah. And that's probably my, you know, my biased perceptions, because I'm sure there's some really good magic out there also, but it's never been a subject that pulled me at all.
Right. And so the term occult is used sometimes, and it does have a negative connotation.
Yeah.
When you figure out, you look at where did that come from? It comes primarily from the Catholic Church back in the medieval times. Because there were a lot of people at the time, that, as in any indigenous society, who were using methods that we would call magic now, including in the East, the same kinds of methods, everything from herbalism to clairvoyance and all of those kinds of phenomena. They were a significant challenge to the power of the church. And so the church outlawed it, and that's what gave rise to the Inquisition. The Inquisition killed an enormous number of people who were doing these practices. Whether they actually were doing it for real or not, nevertheless, they were caught up in the dragnet. And the Western tradition then has been influenced very strongly by the way that religion has regarded these kinds of phenomena. So one example is, take the Catholic ceremony of the Eucharist.
Right.
It is explicitly a magical practice. It is okay to do it if you're anointed within the church. It is not okay to do exactly the same thing if you don't happen to be anointed within the church.
Right. Well, they don't want anybody messing with their business, let's face it.
Yeah, that's basically what it is. So the Eastern culture is very different about this. The Eastern culture said that you individually actually could have these same mystical experiences and in commune with God or mysticism. Like, that wasn't challenging anybody. That's
right.
One of the essences then of yoga, which is a self-union with the universe. But that wasn't the way that it developed in the West.
Well, that's very interesting, because also, you know, when I started Yoga Fit in the late 90s, and we would go into some smaller towns in the southern part of the United States, we literally had people out with picket signs that said yoga equals devil worship.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's changed a lot. When I first came out with an audio tape way back in the 90s, you know, the debate was whether or not, can we even call it yoga, or should we just call it like simple stretch for fitness? Mm-hmm. So that word yoga has also been tiptoed around a lot. I've done several trainings in China, and I know that the Chinese government, I was not a huge fan of yoga for quite some time either. I mean, and look, I get it. I like to call yoga the gateway drug. And by that, I mean, when I really started my yoga practice, it opened up my mind to 1,000 other possibilities and opportunities for self-growth and personal growth. And yoga was kind of the catalyst for me to make that happen, because even, you know, I was doing asana practice and meditation, but there's something inherent in the poses, the way they work, the chakras, the nadis, that just, you get unified, you get opened up. I believe in as the body, so goes the mind, which is why I believe it's so important to have a strong, balanced, and flexible body, so that you become permeable to the messages of the universe. And also why meditation is so great for emptying the garbage out of the mind, and also leaving you in a state of no mind, which is then when you get the messages from the universe and you can connect with yourself and you can connect with higher consciousness. You know, all these things from practicing yoga, I think it's probably very threatening to a lot of different cultures, societies, political groups, and obviously religious institutions, which make their money keeping their people donating and harnessed to the church pew.
It's true. I mean, it's organized religion to some extent is a matter of social control.
Very much so. I mean, there have been many philosophers who said that. Who was it? Was it Marx that said that religion is the opiate of the mind?
Of the masses, yeah.
Yeah.
So it is, I mean, some of that is certainly true. Some of it also, though, is that people need meaning in their lives. Like we eat meaning. We have to have meaning. If you don't have meaning, you perceive the universe as nihilistic and pointless and leads to suicide.
And don't we even have something within our, I don't know if you're going to call it the brain or the mind, that they've found that actually proves that we do need to have this type of connection, like that we're seeking it as human beings on this planet?
Yeah, I don't know if there's a brain center for that, but I mean, certainly from a psychological perspective, each of us needs some meaning. It's as important as nutrition. So for many people, religion provides that meaning, right? Because we're all of us at some point are always wondering, why am I here? You know, what are we doing? Why do people suffer? All of those kinds of questions are very, very important. And so for some people, religion provides that, which is fine.
Yeah, I will say that as someone in the health and wellness industry, now going on 25 years, I just said this at the conference I returned from. I would love to see more churches encourage their members and participants to really take better care of their bodies. Mm-hmm. I mean, because the fact of the matter is, we worship in the body temple. When you pray, if you pray, whether you pray in the church or your living room or out by the ocean at sunset, you're in your body temple. So shouldn't we all take the best care of that body temple that we can? Because one, it's housing our spirit. Two, it needs to last for our lifetime. And I would just love to see more religious institutions push the message of true health and wellness.
Interestingly, when you look at the Yoga Sutras, you ask, well, why were the asanas part of classical yoga? The reason is that you needed to make your body strong enough so that you could sit still for 8 hours.
Yeah.
Because the goal was meditation. It was really transformation by the mind. But you can't do that unless the body is strong enough.
Exactly. You need to ready the body for meditation. And that's what our yoga practice certainly gives us.
Yep.
And I also believe, and we believe this at Yoga Fit, that your yoga practice can be truly a moving meditation. If, you know, the instructor's not talking too much and the music is not too disruptive and people aren't busy looking in the mirror to see what John looks like in his poses in the back of the room, mm-hmm. or comparing themselves to others, at Yoga Fit, our essence is no expectations, no competition, no judgment, just breathing, feeling, and staying present in the moment, which that being present in the moment really opens us up to all of these superpowers. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes. So we've done surveys with people who were beginning meditators up to advanced meditators and gave them a list of different kinds of experiences that would be labeled psychic and asked them, how many of these have you had? Well, roughly 75%. From beginning to advanced meditators, whether they were using it through a yoga path or just meditation, they all experienced it, or 75% had these experiences. We did another survey among scientists and engineers, where we gave a list of 25 different kinds of psychic experiences without using those terms, and asked, which of any of these have you ever had experienced of these 25? And to our surprise, 94% of scientists and engineers said that they had experienced at least one of the 25 experiences, and on average, 8. So that's like almost everyone has had these experiences spontaneously. The difference is with disciplined meditation, either through yoga or some other path, it is more than spontaneous. It will happen more often. Eventually, if you're really lucky and have some talent, you can make these effects.
I was going to ask, can you will it?
Yes, you can will it because some of the elementary kinds of psychic experiences, primarily precognition, eventually can be cultivated.
Yeah, can you go into, I know there's a couple of different categories. There's precognition. Some people hear voices, and I'm not talking about like schizophrenic people. Some people see images. For me, I remember one of the first really strong messages I got. It was while I was in college, I was at the gym and I was stretching, kind of doing some yoga after a workout. And it's like the sky parted and I saw white letters written in the cloud. And the message was that I was going to be very successful in the health and fitness industry. And I remember it to the day. And you know, because we have 60,000 thoughts a day, I think it's challenging for a lot of people to separate out that intuition and that insight from the chattering of the mind. Do you have any tips for our listeners in how to differentiate between, you know, the mind stuff and the more elusive superpowers?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. It's a little bit like asking, how do you get to Carnegie Hall? It's practice.
And depends on where you're coming from.
Yeah. If you do enough practice and you begin to learn to discriminate between, is this me or not me? It's not easy to do that because sometimes you really can't tell the difference. And if you push it even more and you go into a mystical state, there is no distinction between you and others. So it's not possible even. I mean, it's not only that it's not possible. What brings to mind is this great statement from Ramana Maharshi, another Indian sage, where somebody asked him, Ramana, how do we deal with other people after being a yogi for a long time? How do we deal with other people? And his response was, there are no other people. And so it gives you a sense then that if you feel a pain, it's difficult sometimes to tell, is this me or is this somebody else? Am I feeling a telesomatic resonance with somebody else? It takes a long time to figure out the way to discriminate between you and the other, because at a very deep level, there is no difference.
Right. That's beautiful. And speaking of mystical experiences, I'm a fan of plant medicine. And I have been on some ayahuasca journeys where I was able to do remote viewing, seeing, like, I saw someone very close to me, and I was in Costa Rica at the time. I saw this person at the Soho House in Istanbul, a place that I had never been, and saw the people that were there, the lighting and all of that. Turns out this person was there during the time I was doing the plant medicine journey. And then when I went to the Soho House in Istanbul, it was exactly like I had seen it on my plant medicine trip. And, you know, plant medicine is very popular these days among certain groups of people. Many mystical experiences happen. What are your thoughts on, does plant medicine increase these powers when you're not on the plants? And has any research been done in this area?
Yeah, so there are some studies that have been done looking at things like precognition and telepathy, mostly with psilocybin.
Okay.
And so one of the reasons why there isn't more is partially because of the history of Schedule I drugs that made it difficult to do this. I've talked to people who are typically psychiatrists who are using it for various kinds of therapy, LSD and psilocybin, and they are very interested in the psychic component because their clients talk about these things all the time. So these experiences do occur. The problem is that when you're in that kind of an altered state, the last thing in the world that you can think that would be interesting to do is an experiment, right? You just don't, like, you think this is the silliest thing in the world to do. I'm one with the universe. Why do I care about something as silly as telepathy? So it is a challenge just from an experimental point of view. Nevertheless, there have been something like 24 studies that have been done. Overall, you get a better result in those studies than you do in an ordinary state.
So what did the studies reveal? I'm so curious.
Well, they reveal similar to what you were saying, spontaneous forms of telepathy and clairvoyance primarily is what happens. Occasionally, you'll get people who are in a group that are taking one kind of medicine or another who will have shared experiences, which is also interesting, shared dream-like, telepathic-like experiences, which they can share afterwards, and they discover that, sure enough, they were in the same place, which is not where your body is.
Right.
This you can travel back in time to look at the Eleusinian mysteries of the Greek mystery schools, which was very popular back then. We're slowly getting into a change in culture now where something like this will begin to happen again, we hope. It is still a challenge for people who want to control drugs. And fortunately, there are movements afoot that are saying we shouldn't control plants. These are plants.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They're plants and they've been used by different cultures for thousands of years.
Right. But they are a challenge to religion and a challenge to government.
And they're also a challenge to the pharmaceutical industry.
Yes, although the pharmaceutical industry is becoming very interested in things like psychedelic analogs, right? Creating synthetic versions, which may or may not work as well as the original plant, because they are so effective. So that's happening. And whether we like it or not, eventually we're going to find that there are analogs of psilocybin, for example, that are used and probably very effectively in therapy, because then you can charge for it.
Yeah. And I know that psilocybin is legal in a lot of states now. So I'm also wondering, do you think that use of the plants, whatever the plants are, will increase our superpowers? It's kind of like a muscle that we're just getting stronger over the course of time. Even if we're not in the gym, we're still pretty strong when we go to pick up a suitcase. Do you think it's the same for the plants and superpowers?
I think there is a case can be made that yes, that once you have anchored a memory about what it is like to go into that mental state, that you'll be able to go back there.
That makes perfect sense, because you probably created some new neural pathways as a result.
Yeah, or even just having an experience that you can remember. So the memory of it, well, you can bring it back into that state. For some people, this is not so good. Like if you have a bad trip, so-called, that can create its own form of PTSD, because now you remember that too. So that's why the therapists are using these compounds are saying it's extremely important to have the right set and setting.
And the right group with you as well, that you feel safe and secure. When I did ayahuasca, I went to a retreat center in Costa Rica and we did about 5 nights of it. Mm-hmm. And they had medical supervision and, you know, it was a really great experience, because some nights I could pick up where the last journey left off. Yeah. And then other nights I would deconstruct every friendship and relationship I ever had in my life. So every night was different. There were some similarities. But it's certainly a whole nother world to explore for sure.
Yeah.
So on a more practical note, if people are interested in increasing these skills, what should they do?
Well, probably the safest and gentlest entree is through yoga and meditation. It's because it's really all about a matter of how do you perceive the world? How do you begin to perceive the world differently than the everyday world that we're all bound to experience by virtue of having a body?
Right.
So that's the easy way. The fast way is probably through psychedelics. And that doesn't work for everyone, just like yoga doesn't work for everyone. Works for most people, but not everyone. And
I think yoga probably works and should work for most everyone.
Most.
And I think that because there's so many different styles of yoga and so many different forms and so many different ways to practice, that I encourage anyone who's starting a practice to find what works for them. And they'll know it when they find it. And sometimes it's going to take 2, 3, 4, 5 different tries with different instructors and different programs to find what works for you.
Yep. Same goes for meditation.
Yeah.
Same goes for psychedelics. Some psychedelics work really well for you and others will not. So that's why people say, what should I do? Well, the true answer is try everything.
Try everything. I love that. We should make up t-shirts that say try everything.
Well, I think Shakira actually sang a song by that title in the movie, in one of those cartoon movies.
Okay.
Something like that.
Didn't see that one.
Yeah. It was called Zootopia.
Okay.
That was very nice. Yeah.
So I know that people up in your neck of the woods in Northern California use a lot of, you know, microdosing with LSD and such. Curious as to your thoughts on that as well, while we're on the topic of substances.
Some people report amazing relief of depression, PTSD, and higher creativity. But again, in that case, there is no single prescription for what microdosing means.
Right. This is very true also. And you sometimes don't know what you're getting. I did a full trip of LSD once in Big Sur when I was 30. And it was, I have to say, one of the most spiritual experiences I ever had in my life. Mm-hmm. The layers of emotion, stuff that was going through a breakup at the time, that stuff started to peel away like the skin of an onion. And I guess about an hour and a half in, I was just in a state of breath and spirit where I wasn't even really in my body, but I was like hiking in Big Sur. And it was such a powerful experience and such a beautiful place that I never felt the need to do it again, because I thought, how am I ever going to top that? And I had no desire to even try. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, but it was a game changer for sure.
And this is pretty much is very similar to what we're hearing about psychedelic therapies in general, that somebody with severe long-term PTSD can be essentially cured in one shot because of that experience, because it reconstructs your sense of self. In the old days, you might spend 30 years of meditation to get to that same spot.
Or $30,000 in therapy.
Yes. That's why I think we're moving into a space where the old fears about how these drugs will change your chromosomes and all that stuff, all of which have been completely debunked as basically fear-mongering, we'll get into a new space where maybe we can actually make an advancement as humans into a new level of consciousness.
And maybe we can start truly healing people, and the planet needs so much healing now more than ever. I wish they would just, you know, put the stuff in the water instead of fluoride. I think we'd all be a lot better off and everyone would just give each other a hug and get along.
Yeah, but. So the but is that, again, set and setting are so important in any time you're thinking about a major consciousness transformation, that if you don't do that and you put it in the water or the air...
Oh, that's a good point, Dean. That's why you're a scientist and I'm not.
No, somewhere between 2 and 5% of the population will become psychotic. You don't want to do that.
Okay.
We need to respect the power of these methods.
Right. Well, we're a minute to close. I can't believe how quickly time has gone by. I'm going to read your new book that's not quite so new anymore, but Real Magic. If our listeners haven't read Super Normal and you're a fan of yoga, meditation, or anything mystic, check that book out, Super Normal. It's amazing. And I want to come and hang out with you in Northern California. So please let me know when you guys are doing a conference or when you're opening your new center, because I'm going to be the first one signing up.
Great.
And where can we find you on social media?
DeanRaden.com is my website and has links to all of the various social media.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being here today. It's so great to see you again. And thank you for all the great work that you're doing and supporting what we do in yoga and meditating with some real scientific fact about how this all works. I think we're going to have you back on and just spend one whole thing on just on how we can levitate, because that's, I'm sure, interesting to some of our listeners as well.
Well, also, I need to tell you my story about Anton the traveling ghost.
Okay, well, we're going to have you back. I'm going to have you rebooked immediately. Thank you so much for being here today. Namaste.
My pleasure.
So thank you all so much for tuning into this episode of Make America Healthy with Dr. Dean Radin. And please visit us online at yogafit.com to check out any of our workshops, conferences, special events. We're in every city doing trainings. We're virtual online doing special programs. We specialize in trauma-sensitive yoga and many other forms of yoga. So whether you've got back pain or want to strengthen your core, come visit us at yogafit.com. You can use the code VOICE22 to save 15% at checkout. We'd also like to thank our friends, globalhealing.com, makers of very great quality supplements. And you can save on any supplements that you might need at globalhealing.com by using the code YOGAFIT15. And until next time, everyone, stay curious, stay healthy, share this information. Please share this show and check me out at BethShaw.com and on Instagram, Beth Shaw Health. Namaste, everyone. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on Make America Healthy. We hope we've given you some tools you need to take back control of your health. Until next time, we wish you a healthy and wonderful week.